The Leslie Marshall Show, a true democracy in talk radio. Of, for, and by you, the people.
Live from our nation's capital, it's Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.
Welcome to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. I'm Brad Bannon. I'm a national Democratic strategist and pollster, a columnist for The Hill in Washington, DC, and a political analyst for news radio station KNX in Los Angeles. My company, Bannon Communications Research, polls for progressive issue groups, labor unions, and Democrats. Mondays on Deadline DC, I talk to the people and the players behind the politics and policies that drive our great nation forward. With us, as always, is our intrepid executive producer, Mark Grimaldi, who's on board to make sure the trains run on time and the show stays online. We have two great guests today on Deadline DC. In the first half hour, our guest is Alex Lawson, who is the executive director of Social Security Works. He's here to talk about the GOP threats to Social Security. Then in the second half hour, our guest is Joshua Green, a writer for Bloomberg Businessweek. He's here to talk about his new book, The Rebels, which talks about the rise of progressive populists in the Democratic Party. Before we get to our first guest, we're going to play this clip from Donald Trump, who opens Pandora's box when he talks about, well, there are things we might do with Social Security.
There is a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting, and in terms of also the theft and the bad management of entitlements, tremendous bad management of entitlements.
Okay. That's a pretty threatening clip. It's very general. There are things we can do, which again is like opening Pandora's box. Our guest again is Alex Lawson, who's the executive director of Social Security Works. Alex, what do you think Donald Trump means when he says there are things we could do?
He means that there's ways that he can reach his hand into our pockets and steal our Social Security benefits. That's the only plan the Republicans have. The only surprising thing there is Trump is basically off his game, and you can see it in a variety of ways. I think he fell asleep in the courtroom today.
Yeah, he did.
So he usually is dances better, but the CNBC host, to their credit, actually put him really hard on the spot, because usually they lie using the word entitlement, so they don't actually say Social Security, and then they're like, oh, I didn't mean it. But the host said, you know, if we don't cut entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, we're never going to get our debt under control, which A, is false, but B, that was the question. So there's no room for doubt. What Donald Trump answered is, there's a lot that we can do in terms of cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And that's exactly in line with every official statement that the Republicans put out. The Republican Study Committee, the RSC, is the official policy branch in the House, and their budget decimates Social Security. You know, every year Donald Trump was president, he put forward a budget that decimated Social Security. So the only thing that's a little different is he's usually better at lying when he's running for office. But again, I think he was sort of comfortable because it's CNBC, so he thought he was talking to his investor class people, the billionaires who are actually in charge of him. B, it was super early in the morning, so I think he was tired. And C, he's slipping just across the board, which is on display every time there's a camera on him. You can see he's losing it.
Yeah, by the way, Donald Trump went on trial this morning in New York City for business fraud using covering up the payment of corporate money to hush up the his affair, if you can call it that, with porn star Stormy Daniels. And apparently he fell asleep this morning during the trial. Let's get back to the Republican study group. They came out with the budget you referred to, I think about a month ago, maybe longer than that. They decided to cross over the third and fourth rails of American politics by cutting Social Security and calling for a national abortion ban. First of all, could you tell us more about what the Republican study group proposed in terms of cutting Social Security?
Yeah, so, and I will also just expand slightly. It's not just the RSC and it's not just in this budget. This is consistently the Republican line. It's the only plan that Republicans have on Social Security is to massively cut benefits for everybody. They massively cut benefits for current beneficiaries. They massively cut benefits for future beneficiaries. They cut benefits to do one thing, protect billionaires from paying more in taxes. So you can actually go and look at every RSC budget going back, and you'll see the same thing over and over again. So it is the Republican plan is to cut Social Security benefits. They do it in a multitude of ways, and it's actually not that important for your listeners to like delve into it unless you're a nerd like me. So the current one in vogue is to raise the retirement age. They're like, oh yeah, everyone's living longer, so we'll just raise the retirement age. A, everyone's not living longer. Some people are living longer. Rich people, for example, are living longer. But in aggregate, American life expectancy has been falling for the past few years.
It has been.
Not only because of the pandemic, actually, just on its own. So no, everyone's not living longer. And B, it's a trick. It's a policy trick. So so-called raising the retirement age, that has nothing to do with the age at which you can retire. That's just the label for a mathematical entity that is your maximum benefit age. And so if you take that into the future, you're actually just cutting 7% across the board to everyone's benefit by each year you raise it. So to raise it from 67, which is where it is currently, it was raised from 65 to 67 in the 80s by Ronald Reagan. To take it from 67 to 70 is a 21% benefit cut for every single person in the country. And they're still taking, with still our money going in to Social Security, it's ours, right? They're taking the benefits, but it's not their money, it's our money. So that's what the RSC proposed. That's what Donald Trump is talking about. That's what Republicans do when it comes to Social Security.
Well, let me ask you this question, Alex. The Republicans have been basically trying to dismantle Social Security ever since it was created during the New Deal. And usually when they cross the third rail of American politics and try to do something to Social Security, reform is what they call it, they get burned. So my question is, why do they do this? Because every time they try something like this, it hurts them politically, sometimes significantly.
Yeah,
what's the deal there?
It will again. They'll get burned. We will win. Social Security's not getting cut on my watch. But the reason is also quite simple, Brad. There are a handful of billionaires on Wall Street who call the tune. They're the ones playing the music that these politicians are dancing to. This is how the politicians get that billionaire money. So they say these things and pursue these policies. I mean, some of them believe in it. You know, I'm sure there's some like who are actually just like bad people who want to, you know, steal money from seniors and people with disabilities. That's true. But primarily, you're talking about a spineless class of cowards who are in this town and they're willing to rob the people because their billionaire paymasters tell them to. And that's what's going on. These billionaires don't want to pay more in taxes. So they're going to cut our Social Security benefits. President Biden is really clear. He says, I'm going to expand Social Security benefits for everybody,
yeah,
and I'm going to pay for it.
That's something I want to talk about after the break. We do have to go take a quick break here to give our radio listeners a very short vacation. However, we're going to continue with our feed on Facebook, video feed on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube with our guest, Alex Lawson, the Executive Director of Social Security Works. And Alex just raised a subject I want to talk about after the break, which is Democratic proposals to strengthen the system. So we're going to go to take a very short break now. But if you're watching us on YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter, stay with us, and we'll be back to our radio listeners in a couple of minutes.
Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Hey.
Tonight, let's all agree once again to stand up for seniors. Many of my friends on the other side of aisle want to put Social Security on the chopping block. If anyone here tries to cut Social Security, Medicare, or raise the retirement age, I will stop you. The working people, the working people who built this country pay more into Social Security than millionaires and billionaires do. It's not fair. We have two ways to go. Republicans can cut Social Security and give more tax breaks to the wealthy. That's the proposal. Oh, no. You guys don't want another $2 trillion tax cut? I kind of thought that's what your plan was. Well, that's good to hear. You're not going to cut another $2 trillion for the super wealthy. That's good to hear. I'll protect and strengthen Social Security and make the wealthy pay their fair share.
That was, of course, President Biden in his State of the Union address. Alex, let me ask you this question. When you were watching that, what was your reaction when you saw the State of the Union alive?
Hooray! Yeah, it was a great moment. We've been working with the administration, so we've been pushing them to really pick this fight on Social Security, as you said, to go on offense. The Democratic ideas are so much stronger. I went over some of them with your streamers. But in general, what Biden is talking about is it's really this simple. Republicans want to cut Social Security benefits and give the money to their billionaire paymasters. And Democrats want to expand Social Security and pay for it by having millionaires and billionaires pay the same rate into Social Security as the rest of us. So it's just a common sense matter of fairness. And the only thing, and I think there's something about like keep calling it the third rail. It's true, but it's only the third rail, i.e. it'll kill your political career if you try to cut it. The message that too many Democrats got for too long, I think, was don't talk about Social Security, which is the exact wrong message. Like pick up the third rail and wield it as a political cudgel, because the Democratic ideas on Social Security are wildly popular, not only with Democrats, but with independents and Republicans. It doesn't matter who you talk to in this country. Everyone loves Social Security. The problem for Democrats is not enough people know that Democrats are the ones who are trying to expand benefits and pay for it by taxing billionaires. So we just have to get that word out there. And the best way to do it is for President Biden to do exactly what he did in that clip. Take it to the Republicans. Take the fight to the Republicans and make them defend their position.
In politics, the best defense is a good offense. By the way, I want to mention, you mentioned in the previous segment, false proposals to strengthen Social Security by Senator Sanders and Warren. In the next half hour, our guest is going to be Joshua Green, who's the author of a new book, The Rebels, which talks about progressive populists like Senators Sanders and Warren standing up for traditional democratic values. So you want to stay for that. Let me ask you this question, Alex. We're in the middle of a presidential campaign. There are a lot of hot button issues out there. Reproductive rights is a big issue. Immigration is a big issue. How do you think the discussion over about Social Security is going to play in campaign 2024?
It plays central. So I think because it's so popular with everyone, it is broadcast, but it's also more narrowly cast. So specifically aiming at seniors as a population who have shown a tremendous ability to actually sway elections, because seniors, they vote every single time. Every election that happens, seniors are going to vote in it. It's not just expanding Social Security, taxing billionaires to pay for it. It's also adding drug price negotiation to Medicare, right? The President Biden is the only guy who came to this town and didn't just say he was going to lower drug prices. He took on pharma and won with the Democrats in Congress. That is an amazing accomplishment. So he's definitely going to put that in. He already is putting that in the center of his case. You know, this is what he did. And then in what's left to do, lower more drug prices, that's part of it, but also expand Social Security for everyone. So we expect to see this message just central to the campaign throughout. You're gonna see a lot of messaging out there, and I think there's a lot of issues, but seniors and activating seniors is going to play everywhere. It's going to be part of the strategy in every single state. So and it's such a massive difference between how people feel about the policies that Joe Biden and the Democrats support, expanding Social Security, taxing billionaires, versus Donald Trump and the Republicans cutting Social Security and giving that money to billionaires. I expect to continue to see it just in the center of the campaign. It's not always going to be the A block number one message, but it'll be top five all the time. And then when there is a hook, you'll see it elevated to number one. I mean, there's also Donald Trump has said some really terrible things, so I'm sure he's going to say more. And every time that happens, the campaign will be ready.
Well, let me ask you this question. In 2020, voters over 60 were the most strongly supportive of Donald Trump. President Biden did much better with younger voters, but old voters were very dedicated to Trump, and they were again in 2022 in the midterm elections. Do you think this Social Security issue can break up some of that senior support for Social Security, or is it an issue that's better geared to younger voters who feel their benefits may be threatened?
So there's a few answers there, just as a pollster, you know this. One of the things is that over 60 is a big, big bucket, and it encompasses two pretty different demographics. So in fact, you're looking at a lot of older Gen X and younger boomer men. That's the main support for Donald Trump's America. This is bitter micro-generation. Who, I don't know, they got their brains poisoned by Rush Limbaugh or something. But older Americans, so seniors, the silent generation, you actually saw massive swings from the Obama era through 2022. And in politics, you don't say need to win every generation or every demographic, right? So if you do
Alex,
better.
I'm going to have to interrupt you. I'm sure we'll have you on again during the course of the campaign. Our guest in this half hour was Alex Lawson, the executive director of Social Security Works, talking about Republican threats to Social Security and Medicare and the Democratic plans to strengthen Social Security. We'll be back with our next guest, Joshua Green, to talk about his book, The Rebels, And it really follows nicely with this discussion about the aggressive efforts of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and AOC to strengthen Social Security. We'll be right back after this message. Welcome back to Deadline DC with Brad Bannon. Our guest in this half hour is Joshua Green from Bloomberg Businessweek. He's here to talk about his new book, The Rebels, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the Struggle for a New American Politics. It's a great book. I'll hold it up. I always take off the book covers when I read the book so I don't spill coffee on it. Then I lose the book cover. But it's a great book. I finished reading it over the weekend. And we're going to have a lot of fun talking about it. Joshua, by the way, I love the book. I follow this stuff closely, I like to think. One thing, so I can do the show every week. I thought you had a very original take on the struggles within the tensions within the Democratic Party. And in the last half hour, we talked with Alex Lawson from Social Security Works, and he talked about, one of the things we talked about with Alex was, I feel, and I think Alex agreed with me, the Democratic Party's been too defensive over the years. And we talked about attempts by Senator Sanders and Senator Warren to be more aggressive fighting for improvements in Social Security rather than just defending from the Republican attacks. Why don't you talk about, and you know, you start, I want to talk about the individual players, but why don't you start talking about the financial crisis in 2008 and the impact it had on the Democratic Party and the nation?
Yeah, and that's really kind of the catalytic event that sparked the idea for this book. I've been a reporter in Washington covering Democrats and liberals since 2000. And, you know, and one of the things that kind of stood out to me, especially in the years after the 2008 financial crisis, was just what an enormous shift that it produced in American politics generally. My last book, Devil's Bargain, in 2017, was about the rise of Steve Bannon and Donald Trump. And a lot of the backlash that caused that gave rise to this right-wing brand of populism. But to me, an equally interesting story was the fact that it also gave rise to a left-wing politics that was sort of best embodied, I think, by my three characters, Warren, Bernie, and AOC. And so when I wanted to write a history of the modern Democratic Party and the rise of this brand of left populism, that seemed like the natural place to start. Because when I got to Washington in 2000, that kind of brand of left-wing populism wasn't really articulated by anybody. I mean, the party was really more or less controlled by Wall Street. And yet almost immediately after the crisis, with kind of the rise of Warren, who was the TARP oversight cop in charge of the bailout, you know, from kind of that point on, you really saw emerging this strain of left populism that's now become very influential in the Democratic Party. And that's really the backbone of The Rebels, which is the name of my new book.
Okay, let's talk about three Democrats are the focus of your book, Senator Bernie Sanders, Senator Elizabeth Warren, and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Let's talk about, you start with Elizabeth Warren and her role. What role has she played in the revigorization of the Democratic Party?
Well, you know, to me, she was really the singular catalytic figure in the wake of the financial crash. And, you know, when you think back on her career and her circumstances, a very, very unlikely person to emerge as a high-level national politician. Warren, at the time of the 2008 crash, was a Harvard Law School bankruptcy professor, you know, fairly well known within her small academic subspecialty, but certainly not anybody in the broader world had heard of. But I tell the backstory in the book about how she'd been discovered by Harry Reid and Chuck Schumer. Back in the early 2000s, she would come and testify about the bankruptcy bill, about middle-class economic issues, and both of them were struck by how well-informed and articulate, but also able to talk about like difficult economic concepts in normal plain English that Warren was. And so in the aftermath of the bailout, which, as we all remember, was rushed through Congress, most people didn't even know what was in there. One of the small provisions in the legislation said that they were going to establish an oversight board, basically a group of kind of five cops who would police how this bailout was spent. It had no power. It had no subpoena power. It wasn't a sexy job. The top Republican on the board quit within 2 weeks. But Warren agreed to be its chairperson, and she used that really as a platform to kind of seize Washington media and Democrats by the lapels and provide a counter narrative to the official narrative that we were hearing first from the Bush White House and later on from the Obama White House. And as she began to clash with Obama officials like Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, who she did not think was doing enough to help the middle class, it really sparked the rise of a populist movement that spread across social media and pretty quickly made Warren into a nationally known political figure, even though she was still a bankruptcy professor at Harvard who had not yet decided to embark on a career in electoral politics.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you deal with in the book is the conflict between Elizabeth Warren's approach to dealing with the financial crisis and the Obama administration's approach to the crisis. Can you explain that difference and how it led to conflict?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really the central tension in my book. And I think the central tension ideologically, sorry about that, inside the Democratic Party over the last 30, 40 years. If you look at what Democrats stood for from about the time of Jimmy Carter's loss in 1980, all the way up until the financial crisis, it was a party that was sort of adrift and increasingly willing and even eager to embrace Wall Street and the business community. And as that process moved along, you wound up with third way Democrats like Bill Clinton, who are very friendly to markets, not only raise money from Wall Street, but eventually put top Wall Street figures in charge of policymaking, people like former Goldman Sachs CEO Robert Rubin. All of this diminished, I think, the power of liberals and the populist left in the Democratic Party until we as a country saw the downsides of governing with only the financial community in mind. That was a crash of 2008 and 2009, and immediately it caused pain and suffering among hundreds of millions of Americans, many of them in the middle class. We all remember now what was referred to as TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, which essentially was the government's response to that crisis. And that was to hand hundreds of billions of dollars to recapitalize the Wall Street banks that were crashing. The theory behind that was that if they could prop up the banks, if the Obama administration could, and get the economy growing again, then a rising tide would lift all boats. But what Elizabeth Warren and a lot of other people pointed out was that all of the help from the government was going to benefit the same people that had just caused the crisis. And the middle class was sort of an afterthought. And that generated enormous amounts of anger in the Democratic base and across the country. You know, on the right, you could see it in the rise of the Tea Party movement. On the left, you could see it with the emergence of Warren celebrity, of Occupy Wall Street. And it really kind of created this fissure within the Democratic Party where you had Democrats like Warren who were willing to, frontally go after Democrats like Tim Geithner and even President Obama, which is something that we really hadn't seen before.
Okay, let's try this. That I thought reading the book was the central conflict. Elizabeth Warren wanted to bail out people who were losing their homes and jobs and the Obama administration, and you talk about the Wall Street influence on the Obama administration, they wanted to bail out the banks, essentially.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, the idea from Obama and Geithner was not just that bankers are great people and we need to help them out. It was that this is the quickest way for the economy to recover in a way that will help the broad middle class. But I think after 20, 30 years of deferring to the market view, of deferring even in Democratic administrations to the wishes of the financial community, the Democrats had really grown deaf to the lives and the problems and the challenges of ordinary middle-class people. And I think the backlash that we saw that Warren sort of became the avatar for was really a sign of how disconnected Democrats had become. And that really started the rise of this movement, which later expanded to include, you know, Bernie Sanders and people like that. And really,
I'm going to have to interrupt you, Joshua. We've got to go to break, but we'll continue this discussion with Joshua Green, the author of a great new book, The Rebels.
When it comes to President Biden, you know, I think we need to really focus and understand that young people are a very strong part of this electorate. We have a diverse coalition in the Democratic Party that has its own concerns, whether it is what's happening in Gaza or any other number of issues. But right now, I think November is going to be about the coalition we can put together and the policy progress we can make between now and then.
You know, you have said in the past, it's not just enough for Democrats to talk about what they are running against. You want the president to be talking about what he's running for. Do you think in this very moment, President Biden is doing a good enough job explaining to voters why they should vote for him and not just against former President Trump?
I think we can certainly do more to be advancing our vision. And I believe that we have a strong vision that we can run on. You know, I think, and for what it's worth, the president has said, if you give me the House and if you give me the Senate and reelect me to the presidency, we will codify abortion rights and the right to choose in this country. We'll codify reproductive rights. I think we can do more. I think we need to be talking more about health care. Of course, me as a progressive, I want to see the age of Medicare drop, whether it's to 50, as the president has discussed earlier, or to zero, as is my preference, to extend a Medicare to all people in the United States of America. But I believe that we can be doing more. We can talk even more about the fact that public colleges and universities should be tuition free or reduced. The president has advanced student loan forgiveness just this month for people who have taken out save loans under $12,000. They will see their loans wiped out. But I do believe that advancing that affirmative vision is going to be very, very important, as well as really laying out and showing between now and November through our governing decisions, our governing decisions, when we have that power in the White House, what we are willing to do with it.
Was Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talking about the need for the Democrats to be aggressive and play offense and move forward rather than just defending against Republican attacks. By the way, I want to mention to our radio listeners that if you'd like to watch us as well as listen to us, you can watch us on twitter.com/Brad Bannon. Or on facebook.com/deadlinedc with Brad Bannon, /videos. Our guest in this half hour is Joshua Green, who's the author of a great new book with lots of insights about modern American politics, The Rebels. The subtitle is Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the Struggle for New American Politics. Joshua, explain the role that AOC played in your book.
Well, she really represents, I think, the rising millennial generation of this left-wing populist movement that's become so important in the decade and a half after the financial crisis. If you look at the original two characters in that story, they're both over 70 years old, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. So I think Ocasio-Cortez is important in several regards. I mean, number one, she's evidence of the strength of this movement in the sense that she was first pulled into Democratic politics as a volunteer for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign in 2016. So you don't need any further evidence of its influence just than to see that. But she's also significant in the fact that her age and her life story really illustrate the effects that the financial crisis had on her generation, and I think helped to explain why these policies have become increasingly popular. AOC was had just graduated from Boston University in the years after the crisis, famously was working as a bartender, struggling to pay bills, struggling to find medical insurance, burdened with student loan debt, and of course was facing a terrible job market in the after effects of the financial crisis, and eventually turned to Bernie Sanders and this radical brand of politics as someone who was a appealing and seemed to understand the struggles of what she and a lot of other people in her generation were going through. And you know, her own story and her own emergence as a political figure in her own right, I think are kind of testament to the strength of these ideas. You know, she kind of ended up deciding to run for what seemed like a no hope House seat in New York State was New York City was occupied by Joe Crowley, who everybody in Washington thought was going to be the next Democratic speaker of the House after Nancy Pelosi. Yeah. AOC and a lot of her allies in a group called Justice Democrats very shrewdly organized and beat Crowley in the Democratic primary, and it produced really nothing less than an earthquake, I think, in Democratic politics. The fact that, A, somebody like Crowley was vulnerable in the first place, and B, that he was beaten by somebody who was kind of embracing this Sanders brand of left Democratic politics, I think really helped expand its influence and convince reporters like me, you know, in Washington, that this is not something that is just a cult of personality around Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. It's a brand of politics that has a broad popular vitality that is especially appealing to people, let's say, under age 40, who born the brunt of the worst effects of that financial crisis. And these people and the politicians that were leading this movement were going to push centrist Democrats like Joe Biden more in the direction of embracing these economic policies that were more focused on the middle class and less focused on Wall Street.
Well, that you bring up my next subject, Joe Biden. Joe Biden, as a United States senator, was known for representing corporate interests, especially the insurance companies, many of which are based in Delaware. He had some tense moments when he had Elizabeth Warren testify before his committee in the aftermath of the financial crisis. My judgment would be that he has incorporated many of the ideas and programs of the progressive populist left into his presidency. How did that happen?
Well, I think that's an accurate observation, and I think it happened almost entirely because of the strength of the movement of these three characters that I write about. I think, you know, part of what drove Democrats, establishment Democrats, to embrace this version of left populism, well, let's be honest, it was the election of Donald Trump, which nobody saw coming, and which I think served as a wake-up call for everybody in the Democratic Party, that Americans were much angrier about the state of the country and what the Democratic Party was doing for them, so much so that they were willing to elect a fraud and a demagogue in Donald Trump. But combined, I think, with Sanders' strength in that election, in the Democratic primaries, it convinced Democrats that they needed to kind of tack back toward the middle class, more toward populist economic policies. And I think Biden, to his great credit, is one of the Democrats who realized that earliest. Let's not forget, he was the vice president. He was in the White House in the aftermath of the 08 crash and could see up close. He knew what it was that his Obama administration was trying to do, I think you could see pretty clearly after a few years that it wasn't working, especially after Donald Trump's election. So that when Joe Biden got to a position of power, made it to the White House himself, rather than treating the populist left as a group of antagonists to battle with, which has been how the left was viewed in the decades before the crash, he viewed them as potential allies and was willing to take up a lot of these economic policies that politicians like Warren and AOC were espousing. And so if you look at what happened after the next great financial crisis that followed the emergence of the COVID pandemic in 2020, Biden passed a lot of middle-class focused stimulus that has done marvels in revivifying the American economy to the point where we have record low unemployment, record high stock market, strong job market, and it doesn't look like we're going to face any kind of a recession heading into the 2024 election.
Yeah, it's. Let me ask you this question: in 2028, when we get around, if we survive this presidential election, and there's still a working democracy, and we have a presidential election in 2028, it seemed to me, reading your book, that the power of the new left or the populist wing of the party is rising. Are they going to have a Democratic presidential candidate who represents these values, or are we going to sort of go back to a middle of the road Democrat?
I think it's pretty likely that they will have somebody. And I mean, if I were betting, I would bet on AOC herself, who will be of age to run for president by then. You know, most of the senior figures in the Democratic Party are so old, they will have left or not be running for president then. So I think you'll have a wide open field where maybe more than one will run to try and claim that mantle of the next Bernie Sanders and see if they can get nominated and elected to the White House.
Okay. I want to thank our guest in this half hour, Joshua Green. And again, I highly recommend you his book, The Rebels. It's a page turner. Even though it deals with complex policy issues, it also deals with very colorful personalities, which moves the narrative along. So I recommend it highly. I also want to thank Alex Lawson from Social Security Works for talking about GOP threats to Social Security. And I also want to thank our Crackerjack executive producer, Mark Grimaldi, who keeps the show going despite my fumbles. We'll be back next week with more Deadline DC with Brad Bannon.